The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution.
Now, let's move on. Actually, I had to call the ambulance service this week, and I have to say, and I know anyone who's making a 999 call, when you have to do it, it's always a distressing situation, but to find somebody on the end of the phone who's so calm, who's so professional, who's completely there to help in a very calm way, it really was a fantastic boost in our lives and in our particular emergency. But that's all in the day's work for the person who was at the other end of the line, whose name I have to say I don't know, but we are very grateful to them. And I'm joined now by three people who regularly deal with life and death calls and emergencies in the course of their work. They're Glenn Ellis, who's a firefighter and paramedic with Dublin Fire Brigade. Aman, I'm not allowed to use your full name, we're calling you James, and that's because of the nature of your work, James. You're a bomb disposal expert. And Gwen Morgan, you're an air traffic controller, and of course, Gwen, that line of work, we're all looking at air traffic controllers' work these days, of course, with that Malaysian Airlines flight. Maybe you'd start first, Gwen. I'm going to ask you all this. What was it that made you want to do something so risky, in a way?
I don't actually think I realised what the job entailed when I applied for it. I applied when I was 20 years old. I just finished a degree in St. Pat's College in Drumcondra. I had studied arts and Irish and geography, and specifically, I was going to go on to become a primary school teacher. I saw an advertisement in one of the national newspapers. It sparked my interest just by looking at it. I did have a friend at the time who wanted to be a pilot. He suggested, you know, maybe that's something you should look at or apply for. And I did. And here I am. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very different to the classroom. Yeah, and Glenn, what about you? What was it about being a firefighter and an ambulance paramedic?
Oh, I'm third generation firefighter, so my father and grandfather before them were firefighters as well. And I seen the way the job acts, how the guys are in the job, how the team works together. So it was a straight option for me. It was no question about it. I suppose anyone listening this morning that knows me as well would know it's all I've ever spoken about and all I've ever wanted to be anyway growing up. So yeah,
why did you feel that as a child? Was it because of the qualities you saw in your dad, I suppose, with all of that? Was it that those qualities of being able to rely on someone?
Yeah, and I mean, people say, you know, it must be great having a dad as a fireman. He's a hero and he's everything he does is great. And yeah, it is, but it wasn't just what he did. It's the guys around him as well. So they all became your uncles. You would just become a big family. So you were going to Uncle John's or Uncle Paul's or whatever it may be, but they're not actually your uncles. They're actually firefighters as well. So you just become part of the family. So you see what happens outside of the job. You very rarely get to see what they actually do because you're not allowed, obviously, but you get to see the family aspect of it and the crew aspect mm-hmm. of it. And that was a big attraction for me as well.
And James, I mean, with Glenn and Gwen, you know, they make life and death calls, but they're so, you know, you're not putting your own life on the line, but you are. So what was it about your line of work that made it attractive?
I kind of came into it by accident, but initially I joined the Reserve Defence Forces as a young guy and in my local town, and I really enjoyed that. And then I went on to join the cadets. And from there, I did a science degree through the Army. They facilitated that. And I went overseas. And while I was overseas, they advertised looking for guys with science degrees and mechanical engineering degrees. And I went for it. And fortunately, I got it. And I ended up in the trade as such. So.
And what do you like about it? What keeps you doing it? Because you're in some pretty scary situations. You've been in Africa recently, haven't you?
I am just recently returned from South Sudan. And I've also served in Chad. On the initial deployment to Chad in 2007-2008. But it's not the dangerous situation. Similar to Glenn, it's, you know, the camaraderie, the team effort, the you know, the ethos of the team. And it's a very individual thing. My job would sound like a very individual task, but it's not. It's about team effort.
But there's always a moment when there's you and there's a device, isn't there? And you know, everybody else is further back and you're right there beside it.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's the nature of the military. You know, the military teaches you to walk towards something when everybody else is walking away. And bomb disposal is like that. But everybody focuses on the device. We have drills, we have procedures, we phase our exercise, our operations, and we have a very systematic approach to how we deal with devices. So the idea, I suppose, of cutting the red or blue wire, you know, it's a bit Hollywood-y, you know.
They have different coloured wires, do they?
A friend of mine says, you know, it doesn't matter if it's the red or blue once it's the right one. But we don't do that. You know, we have a very systematic approach to it. We plan everything. And if the plan changes, We come back and we reassess and we move on from there then. But it's a very much a team effort. Yeah, I'm the officer. I get to walk forward, fortunately or unfortunately. But it's very much a team effort. And everybody on the team has their say. They all have different levels of experience, different levels of education or experience within that education. Mm-hmm. And it's a team effort.
But what about, say, for instance, in a medical emergency, Glenn? Because, I mean, all the planning and training, these things are happening so fast. It's split second. I mean, for instance, if somebody goes into the Liffey, how long do you have?
We'd hit the Liffey in about 3 minutes, less from the time of a call. We can have a swimmer in the water, less than 3 minutes, because we're unique in a sense. When you call 999 last week, you got a Dublin firefighter paramedic if it was in the Dublin area. So as soon as that call comes in and look, someone is in the Liffey, straight away someone gets on a tannoy in my station, Tara Street Fire Station, and it's announced as an SRT incident, Swift Water Rescue incident. At that stage, the guys are running to get into the dry suits, the driver's getting down, getting the car started, and we're on the way. So we're actually out the gate sometimes before the call has even finished, and we're getting the location on the radio where to go. So within Tara Street, we would have one of the crews would go to the incident. So you'd have two swimmers in the back of the fire truck ready to go into the water if required. And another truck would then go down to a rescue boat, which is located at the Jeannie Johnson. And most people who have been at the Jeannie Johnson will see it. It's on a kind of a Lego brick floatable device that it sits on, that we can get it off quickly and get it in the water. So we can have somebody by the casualty anywhere in the Liffey roughly within 3 minutes and somebody in if required. Now, we would not put somebody in the water all the time because it's the last kind of thing we would do, is actually commit somebody to the water for safety reasons. But if they need to go in, they can go in and they can take from the bank, the riverbank, and head in then. Otherwise, the boat will come up and take the patient from the water.
And you know, that's all happening so fast. Does a second seem like very long time? Does your brain kind of, you know, slow down so you're able to make all those technical decisions? And
yeah, but similar to James, we would train and drill regularly on getting to the boat, getting the boat off the quay. So it's automatic. It just kind of kicks in. And medical emergencies as well, it's the exact same thing. When you're working with a crew of six guys at an incident, and for example, a cardiac arrest, and when you have six guys there, everybody knows what everybody else has to do. So it makes your job much easier to do. So you're focused on one part of it. And you always find afterwards, if it's a serious incident, the guard may have to come and take a statement and say, do you remember what happened? And you don't, because you're just so focused on what you have to do, because you know everyone around you is doing the same job as well.
And in air traffic control, Gwen, I suppose the thing is that, you know, that it must be like juggling an awful lot of balls in the air. But, you know, on a normal day, if everything's going grand, in a way it would almost seem normal and banal. But then once one tiny thing starts to go wrong, it could be quite catastrophic.
That's
quite
it,
quickly.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a little bit different from the guys. I suppose they react to emergencies. We, on the other hand, are trying to prevent emergencies from happening between aircraft all the time. Like, you know, so our job is basically to deal with any aircraft that flies through Irish airspace, landing or departing from an Irish aerodrome, that it's done safely. Safety is the main game for us. Then it's efficiency, because obviously we're providing a service to customers. They're paying for the service and they want it done as efficiently as possible. But we have to keep aircraft separated at all times. There's two ways to do it. It's either vertically or horizontally, or laterally, as I should say. So it's 1,000 feet vertically if two aircraft want to fly over the same point at any given time. If they want to stay at the same level, so both at, let's say, 20,000 feet, they have to be 3 miles or more apart in Dublin's airspace. In Shannon's airspace, it's a little bit different. They have to go,
because you know the way
miles.
Sometimes you're on a plane and you look out the window and you see another plane and you're going, I hope that air traffic control now is kept there, because that looks very close to me.
Usually, actually, the perception is when they're that far away, they're usually 1,000 feet above you. It's just a sort of a parallax view. You're getting a little bit of a different view out the window. Either that, or you could be in a holding pattern if you're coming in to land in another airport. You know, 1,000 feet in a racetrack pattern in the sky, you're being dropped down 1,000 feet to come in and land if it's busy. But then, yeah, the nature of the beast with us really is safety and to prevent the emergencies from happening. Not to say that there aren't emergencies, of course there are, and they could start from a medical emergency in an aircraft. And then our action plan has to kick in. And like the guys, we go through huge amount of training for unusual occurrences and emergency events, because if they don't happen too often, we need to know how to react when they do. If you have aircraft coming in to land in Dublin Airport, let's say last week an aircraft came in with, they had a fuel indication warning light on in the cockpit. They were going to come in and land. They were going to land heavy because they had extra fuel on board. They hadn't got to their destination. Diverted into Dublin. That means we have to get everything else out of the way that's ahead of it to land in Dublin. Bring it in as a priority. Ring the Dublin Airport Fire Service.
And what kind of time frame is this all happening in?
It could happen. You could get a call. Maybe the aircraft could be 15 minutes away. So we have time to prepare for that. You could get a call, though, when he is, you know, 10 miles from touchdown and the problem arises. So it's...
And then it's like the movies. Ever been scared, any of you?
Oh, constantly, every day.
Yeah.
Really?
It's not normal. And when you're sitting in, when you're going into a fire as such, you're going into the unknown. It's similar to what Jamie says. The situations of court. When I started training, my training officer said to me, remember, you're always walking in when everyone else is running out. You're going into places where nobody else wants to be. If you had a big enough oven to get into, climb inside and put it on full and multiply that by another 100%, that's the type of heat you're facing in my job. So you're going into a house where you just don't know what's ahead of you, whether the floor is going to be intact, how dangerous the fire is. And we're trying to identify if the fire is going to be lethal as such, if it's too hot to go in, and recognise when it's time to get out. But if you weren't frightened, it wouldn't be normal.
James, the sad reality, of course, is, even though the troubles are over, you've quite a lot of work here at home.
Yeah, it's good for business, I suppose. But at the same time, we've dealt with over 40 devices already this year. Last year we did
40 this year?
Yeah, we've been on 40 call-outs this year.
It's only April.
Yeah, but last year was up, the year before was down. It's not about the numbers, you know. It's about how effectively we can operate, how quickly we can get in a situation.
And do you get more scared of a homemade device, if you like, that's been put together, or how professional are these devices that you're dealing with? Which scares you more?
You're scared. Of course, you're scared. You're doing something that's very unnatural. You're going into a situation that's designed to kill or injure somebody. So, but we react to all calls the same. If we're tasked, there's something wrong. The guards are suspicious of something, and there's something wrong. So we're tasked to go there to prevent the loss of life and to return the situation to normal as soon as possible. So to say you're scared, yeah, but sometimes you don't have time to be scared, and the drills kick in. But sometimes after the fact, you will sit down and you'll go, what happened there? Even though you would have done your drills correctly and all that, you will still sometimes say that. But that's why you have downtime. That's why you need to relax. You need to be, have a normal life outside your job as well,
Yeah, that's actually something, you raised something there I was wondering about. Because the way you see in all the movies, like one of the reasons that all these, cops take to the drink in the cop movies and all the rest and get several million divorces is because when they go home from their kind of adrenaline-filled shifts, it's just so hard to share that with a partner or a significant other. So how do you manage that with family and friends, all of you?
Well, myself in particular, my wife, she's been with me through the whole, since I've gone overseas, through my training, etc.
And how important is it to have that understanding?
Oh, it's very important. My family are the same, but I suppose she's the one I go home to every night and she has to listen to me, So... she understands my job and she knows why I do it, why I like to do it, and what I get out of it.
Yeah. And so, Glenn, of course, coming from the family, I suppose it's kind of part of the family tradition, so people do understand at home.
Oh, they do, yeah. I mean, I've got two boys, two sons as well, and I go home to them and kind of get involved in their hurling, and they have horses and that type of stuff. We do a bit of work with them as well. So it's very hard not to bring it home sometimes. And when you have someone to listen, someone who you can talk to, it makes a big difference. But then your mates are always there, your crew guys are always there, and the social aspects, we get together. And you kind of know if something's not right with one of the guys, and you kind of know you need to make contact with him the next day or so, make sure he's all right, or even go for a walk or a hike or a run or go down to the gym or go for a swim together. So we're all conscious of each other as well. It's one of the benefits, I suppose. We're all, of the three of us, are in the same situation, mm-hmm. where you have a good team around to help you get through the bad times as well.
And Gwen, I mean, I know, there you were going to be a primary school teacher and now here you are, an air traffic controller. Are there many women who go in for it?
I applied in 2001, 2,000 people went for the job, 24 people were accepted and 19 were guys, 5 were girls. It increased a little bit then since that. It was sort of half and half. It's down a little bit again since that. But certainly there's more and more females coming into the job. It's a good... Right.
I'm not sure I want to know this, but is there a story about you checking landing gear yourself?
Yeah, you check the landing gear with the binoculars. Sometimes you can get an aircraft.
Are we reassured here?
Well, they have to know one way or the other whether wheels are down. They can't obviously open the window in the cockpit and look out to see if the wheels are down. They need somebody else to look at. So they'll come in, fly low over the airport, and you get the binoculars and look out, can say wheels are down.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, thank you, all three of you. And on behalf of the public, thank you for the jobs that you do, because we all rely on you and all your colleagues. Thank you for coming in to talk to us about it this morning, to James, to Gwen Morgan and to Glenn Ellis. Just to remind you of that, the first clue, I'll be giving you more clues after the break, but the first clue, if you want tickets to Robert Plant, the snow drives back the foot that's slow, the dogs of doom are howling more. Now, we're going to go back to the presidential visit. And as we were saying, Eric, it was a great week, not just for the president, but also for Sabina Higgins, who wore the most amazing outfits all week. She just looked stunning, and she's generally seen as having done us and the Irish fashion industry, which is a very important industry here in Ireland, incredibly proud. But the business of, so we're going to be talking about that when we get Paul Costello up, because he was one of the people who was at that lunch. She hosted Mrs. Higgins a lunch at the Irish Embassy. I think it was her first solo engagement of the week when President Higgins went off. I forget what else he was doing at the time, but she had all the greats and luminaries of Irish fashion there. Louise Kennedy, of course, who dressed her so much this week, among them Paul Costello. So we're going to be talking to him and also to Nicole Mary Kelby, who's been writing about Jackie Kennedy, who I suppose was the first lady of fashion. We'll have both of those after this break.
1850 715 150.